Okay then, brethren, the last few weeks we've been talking a little bit about the topic of prophecy, end-time prophecy clearly, and been looking at, in particular, the books of Daniel and Revelation. So as a very quick summary, you'll recollect, hopefully, the vision of Daniel chapter 2. We are not turning there. This is of the statue with the head of gold and so on. And the query, which tends to get some debate, is the identity of the fourth kingdom of that statue. This is the kingdom of iron. Rome and Europe is a very popular explanation of that kingdom, and I've said already, I won't repeat it, that that doesn't work very well for me, because essentially the Roman Empire did not smash and pulverize the ones that came before it. We've covered that. However, I've suggested that the Islamic kingdom does fit rather well. We've also looked at the vision of Daniel chapter 8. This is the vision of a ram with two horns going off to war, charging to the north, to the south, and to the west. And then shortly afterwards, there's a counterattack by a he-goat with a large notable horn. And Daniel 8 itself identifies those as Iran or Persia and what it calls Javan, which I believe is mostly Turkey of today. So as a bit of speculation, I'm going to suggest that perhaps the next big event in prophecy, perhaps, underline, perhaps, may be watching Iran and Turkey go to war. What we've seen in Daniel 8, both Turkey and Iran are very powerful nations. Both are prominent virtually every single week in the news. Turkey has very rapidly, like in just the last year or two or three, been moving away from its secular status back towards a more fundamentalist Islamic nation. Its current president, President Erdogan, appears to have a vision of perhaps restoring the old Ottoman Empire, which, by the way, reached up into Austria once upon a time, Vienna. And, of course, Iran has recently been blessed, if that's the right word, with about $150 billion thanks to the generosity of Mr. Obama. And Iran has visions of exercising its dominion across much of the Middle East. Let's have a look at Daniel 8 and verse 4 just for a moment, because I think it highlights something that's taking place in the last week or two or three. And I've suggested in the past that rather than necessarily focusing all our attention on Europe, you know, 10 nations uniting together under the Pope, which you can certainly look at. I'm not saying categorically not. I just don't think it fits very well. But look at Daniel 8, 4, and let's read this in the light of circumstances literally occurring in the last few weeks. Verse 4, I saw the ram, which is pictured as Persia, or today we'd call it Iran. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast could withstand him. So nobody can stop Iran when it gets going. It says, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. So when Iran gets going in the end times, nobody can withstand it, at least in the area it attacks, the north, the south, which is Saudi Arabia, and the west heading towards Syria and Turkey. It says nobody can withstand it. Nobody can deliver. So you're talking here of Iran being extraordinarily powerful. Now, is there anything happening at the moment that could help to explain how it becomes so powerful that nobody could tackle it? The answer is a couple of things. One is, in the last few months, Iran has taken possession of what they're referring to as S-300 surface-to-air missiles. S-300 missiles purchased from my good friends, the Russians. Now, the problem with these surface-to-air missiles is that they're impossible, almost, to overcome. So once Iran has them and deploys them, almost nobody could actually then attack Iran. These missiles are just so good. The experts, if they are such, tell us that the only nation on Earth that could actually overcome these missiles is the USA. And the USA would have to up its game somewhat, send in stealth aircraft and similar to be able to get past the S-300s. Is there any chance the USA would do that? I doubt it. I don't think any appetite for that. And no other country has the ability. Saudi Arabia doesn't. Today, Turkey doesn't. So in other words, once Iran deploys these SAMs, it's hard to see how you could get past them. Also, in the last few weeks, Iran has been taking possession of what they call the Zulfikar ballistic missiles. Now, you could spell Zulfikar different ways. I've got it down here as Z-U-L-F-I-K-A-R, F-I-Q-A-R, Zulfikar. These are ballistic missiles which went on display last weekend. They appear to have multiple warheads and are very accurate. And they can reach, they tell us, Tel Aviv and Haifa. So Iran is gearing up. It has technology and it now has an awful lot of money available to buy things, buy its toys. If you look at Turkey, well, we've seen Mr. Erdogan's power immensely strengthened this year. But just 2 days ago, so again, it's pretty recent, he's been on the warpath again. And you may recollect that the old Ottoman Empire, which ran for about 600 years, came to a conclusion in 1922, 1923, 1924. At that point, a international treaty was signed, which Turkey signed up to, among which it had to yield up sovereignty of a number of islands in the area to Greece. Mr. Erdogan doesn't like that any longer. He's now controversially stated that he wants those islands back. Now, he does not want any longer to accept the terms of this treaty from 1923. So the guy is continuing to push, and he's got this vision, I think, watch Turkey, watch Iran. Okay, that was Daniel 8. And then last week we got as far as Daniel 7, looked at the four beasts of Daniel 7, the lion, the bear, the leopard with his four heads, and then a great and a terrible beast. Now, these four nations are identified as Iraq, Iran, Javan or Turkey, and then the fourth one, again, is where the dispute can arise. Who is this fourth strange, great, terrible beast with the iron teeth and the ten horns? I've said before, I think that's Islam. Others suggest, of course, it may be Rome. Time, of course, will tell. This particular fourth terrible beast has ten horns, but then a little horn pops up after the first ten and subdues three of the first ten. I said last week, there's reasons to believe this is the Islamic Antichrist who will subdue three other Islamic nations, probably Egypt, Libya, and Sudan, for reasons I gave last week. And this horn persecutes the saints, believers, for times and half a time, or 3.5 years. Now, actually today, many Islamic nations already persecute Christians. And of course, they don't see Christians as you and I might, talking about, well, people who keep the Sabbath and holy days to somebody who's a Muslim. if you accept God the Father and Jesus as Christ, then in their eyes, you're a Christian. You're a saint. And at the moment, in many Islamic countries, churches are burned. Christians of whatever persuasion are attacked, persecuted, and often killed. And there's more to come. And then finally, last week, so our recap is almost over, we got as far as Revelation 13 and its two beasts. So let's open our Bibles at Revelation 13 and pick up sort of broadly where we left off. Revelation 13, reading verses 1 through 7. So there are two beasts in this chapter. Read verses 1 through 7. Then I stood in the sand of the sea, and John says, I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns ten crowns, on his heads a blasphemous name. Now we've said this appears to be a composite beast from the prophecy of Daniel, because in Daniel 7 we saw four beasts. One was a lion, one a bear, one a leopard, and one a strange creature. Look at verse 2. The beast which I saw here was like a leopard, his feet like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Oh, those are the three plainly identified beasts of Daniel 7. And the dragon, or Satan, gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. Now this beast here is said to have seven heads. Well, okay, one head for the lion of Daniel 7, one head for the bear, four heads on the leopard, one head on the great and terrible beast. There's your seven heads. The fourth beast of Daniel 7 had ten horns. Verse 1 here says this beast has ten horns. So it does appear to be John is simply seeing, if you like, the final version of this set of beasts from Daniel 7. Verse 3, I saw one of his heads as it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marvelled and followed the beast. So the beast has one head fatally wounded, but it recovers, it's healed. Okay, so what is the mortal wound? Well, depending on whether you choose to believe this passage is referring to Rome and Europe or Islam. If you go the Roman route, then our understanding would be that the mortal wound was way back in 476 AD when Rome was sacked. Okay? If you go with the Islamic route, I would suggest that the mortal wound was 1922 to 1924, not that long ago, when the Ottoman Islamic Empire ended. Verse 4, so they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who is able to make war with him? So a war-making power. And he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. Then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints, who would then escape and be safe. That's what we might like to read in there, for it does say it was granted him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So here verse 5 tells us that this particular beast is given authority or power for 42 months. Now I'd suggest if this is the end time Islamic empire, the 10 horns being 10 Islamic nations in a sort of confederacy, then we're talking of 42 months, 3.5 years, which you'll recognize as quite a significant time. So here it suggests to me that this end-time Islamic empire will have great power for 3.5 years, during which it will persecute the saints, make war with them, and overcome them. right? If you prefer the Roman alternative view, then these 42 months are ancient history. They relate to the healed Roman Empire of 554 AD, all the way down to Napoleon's day in 1814, which is 42 months, being 1260 days or 1260 years. So, in a sense, if we believe this beast is a Roman European beast, then much of this is actually old history. It's time past. It's of little relevance to us. My belief would be, actually, this is the Islamic Empire, 10 Islamic countries combining forces, and the saints are going to be at its mercy for 42 months or 3.5 years. Anyway, we covered that last week, so let's get on to verses 11 through 18, which was a strange second beast, and this is where we sort of finished off last week. Verse 11 of Revelation 13. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. If I'm right in saying this might be the Ottoman Empire, then it has to be restored. It has to be healed, perhaps sometime soon. Verse 13, he, this second beast, performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image or a likeness, a copy, to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image or likeness of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. So we just read about the saints being given into the hand of this first beast empire, and they would be overcome. We're not turning back to Daniel 7, but you'll see the same thing there. The little horn wears out and harasses the saints for time, times, and half a time, it says. Verse 16 here, and he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark, or, alternatively, the name of the beast, or, alternatively, the number of his name. Verse 18, here is wisdom. Let him who is understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666, which, of course, is all pretty much clear as mud. So here we get the second beast. Who is the second beast? What is the second beast? If you come via the Seventh-day Adventist route, you'll understand that this second beast is the United States of America. There's reasons they come to that, but that's for them to explain to you if you're interested. So this is the US of A, because Ellen G. White said so. And the Adventists believe that the American government will one day come after Sabbath keepers and enforce Sunday worship. Get to that in a moment. The more traditional view that you and I would have come up with in our previous years in the church is that this really is the papacy, this beast, or the Vatican. And the two horns you see on it, one horn represents the authority in a religious sense. Obviously, the Pope is over a billion Catholics. They don't tend to obey him very much, but in theory at least, he is a spiritual authority. And the other horn represents the fact that the Vatican has a certain amount of state or government authority. It is a sovereign state itself, very small, there in the Jerome And it sends ambassadors to other countries. So, yeah, okay, maybe that's the sort of the secular part plus the religious part. That's the two horns. Yeah, okay, maybe. The other possibility, what I tend to think is more likely, is that we're talking here about this beast being the Islamic Antichrist or the Caliph. The Caliph is not around today, but when the Caliph arrives, he is the most powerful person in Islam. He has complete, total authority, both spiritually and politically. So if a Caliph arrives on the scene, if he is accepted by the Islamic world as Caliph, he has complete, utter, total authority over all of Islam. Right? And that's what I think we're seeing here. Not here just yet. We have to see the beast healed. And if that's the Turkish Empire, that's still a wee bit ahead of us. Let's pick up here verses 16 and 17. Notice, he causes all to receive a mark on their right hand or foreheads, and that nobody can buy or sell unless one has the mark or the name or the number. So you can't buy or sell. You need this mark. So what is the mark? What is the mark of the beast? Over exciting. What's the mark of the beast? Do we know? Do you want it? You don't actually, but I mean, it says here you can't buy or sell. You go, oh, one more of those then, because you know, I've got to be able to buy and sell. Need to be able to buy fruit and vegetables and petrol for my car. If I'm a self-employed person, I need to have a trade. Got to buy and sell. Got to be able to carry on living, pay the mortgage, all the rest of it. Well, the traditional views of the mark of the beast are it's Sunday worship. So you'd be forced to, quotes, keep Sundays. That's the mark of the beast, because the beast is the Roman Empire and Sunday is its day, so therefore that's the mark of the beast. That's probably the one that we're sort of familiar with. An alternative in recent decades is it's an electronic chip, an electronic tattoo, which might be stamped on your wrist or forehead. And you can think, well, this makes sense in some ways, because at the moment, so much fraud out there. People can steal your identity, ID theft, and they can pretend to be you. They can steal your credit card. They can find out your PIN. What you need is something that is exclusively personal. How about some chip embedded under your wrist or your forehead somewhere, which is you? And as you walk past some barcode scanners, it identifies, here comes Jamie. And we can tell Jamie's bank account's got not much in it. And when he buys a bunch of bananas, it will deduct, a pound or a few euros. And if Jamie is on the wrong side of the government, they don't like Jamie's beliefs, they switch off Jamie's credit on his electronic chip. Now Jamie can no longer buy petrol, use his bank account, travel. So therefore, it's quite a good idea, quite a good theory. That's what it would be. Mark of the beast is something that is stuck in you or tattooed on you. Okay. Ooh. What if it's the Islamic Empire? What if the beast of Revelation 13 is the Islamic Empire and the Caliph is the second beast? What would it be then? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But there's one thing to look at here, which is that you might think if it's an electronic chip, biometric chip, that it's something that might be okay to have because it allows you to travel and buy and sell things. Why wouldn't you want one? God wouldn't be too upset, would he? He knows you've got to eat. If you've got a family, you've got to feed them. God knows that. He's not going to be that upset, is he, if you just take a simple chip, just like having a credit card in your wallet. This time you've got the credit card under your skin. I mean, what's the big deal? Well, it's quite clear that God will not be pleased if anyone takes the mark of the beast. Look at Revelation 14 and read verses 9 through 12. There are three angels come at the end of the age with various announcements. Verse 9 is the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, so I guess we'll all get to hear it. If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead, on his hand, and I'd underline the word worships, because I think you'll see that repeatedly in the next few sort of passages we look at. The key thing here is not just physically getting a mark or a tattoo. There's a reference here to the person happens to worship the beast. Verse 10, then he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. So if we receive the mark, then we'll receive God's undiluted wrath poured out full strength. In other words, God is not pleased at all. Anybody takes the mark, God is going to go after them and is going to pour out his wrath undiluted. But notice a couple of times there, worship the beast. Worship the beast. Taking the mark is tied into also worshipping the beast. This is a matter of the heart, not just having something stamped on your wrist. Look at chapter 16 and read verses 1 and 2. So when you worship, that's actually a declaration in your heart of your allegiance, of your loyalty. And we know that Jesus said you can't serve two masters, serve God or serve mammon. You can't serve, for example, Allah and God. You can't worship Allah and worship the true God. So when it says worshipping the beast, that's talking about a decision in your heart. And that's much more important to God than a mark on your skin. Chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on the earth. There are seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls or vials. Verse 2, so the first angel went and poured out his bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came upon the men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. So once again, there is the mark, but in my view, God wouldn't be upset just by you having a credit card stamped on your skin, but he will be upset if somebody worships the beast or its image and takes the mark. Look at Revelation 19. Revelation 19 and reading verses 19 to 21. This is right up to Christ's return at this point. Revelation 19 and 19. I saw the beast, the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against Jesus, who sat on the horse, and against his army. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet, who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone, and the rest were killed with the sword, which proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse. So once again, we see linked into the receiving the mark, that those who receive the mark appear to also be those who worship the beast. And to me, that's the thing that singles this out. It's a question of the heart, the loyalty, the allegiance, not just put a stamp there so I can go and buy some groceries. Chapter 20 and verse 4. So it's following straight on from that reference to capturing the beast and the false prophet who had deceived those who took the mark of the beast. Chapter 20 and verse 4. And I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So if you receive the mark and worship the beast, God will stomp on you. big time. If you don't receive the mark and don't worship the beast, you'll be beheaded.
Not good options.
So there we go. Some may not see that as an attractive choice, but given a choice, probably beheading is going to be ultimately better than having God after you. Got to say, neither sounds hugely attractive, but there we go. So the thing is, it's the question of the heart, not just, I think, a tattoo. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And of course, when talking of a mark, anyway, it doesn't have to be something visible. A mark doesn't have to be something which is observable, physical. It can be something that only God could see, because look at Revelation 9, verses 1 to 4. Revelation chapter 9 and verses 1 through 4, it talks of something, you know, similar to a mark, which is called a seal. Then the fifth angel, these are the various trumpets, the seven trumpets, this is the fifth trumpet. Then the fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, the abyss, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. Now, this seems a bit symbolic. It's not 100% clear what this may be. I've speculated, and it is speculation, so underline, ring the bell like Mr. Coulter would do. These could be particularly horrific demons, which are being loosed from the pit on the earth to add to the destruction of this time. But that's just speculation. But notice what they are told. These aren't locusts. You know, grasshoppers aren't what are in mind here. This is something that looks pretty horrible and strange and is very destructive. But notice verse 4. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So some men, and I suppose some women, will have the seal of God on their foreheads. And these locust creatures told, don't harm those ones. Now, I don't think there'd be something visible. I don't think the seal of God would be something radiating from your forehead. But it's there. And it's a symbol, if you like, of your allegiance and loyalty. Those with the seal of God on their foreheads are the people who are loyal to God. And these locust creatures are told, don't touch them. So it's not necessarily the case that a mark or a seal has to be visible to a human being. Now, okay, we're looking here about, could it be enforced Sunday worship? That's the sort of background that most of us have got. Certainly Sabbath keeping, which we're all doing today, can be considered to be a sign. Exodus 31 tells us that Sabbath keeping is a sign to God, sign of his people. So that's for sure. And of course, you know, keeping the Sabbath holy does affect your mind, does affect your right hand, because obviously you don't do any servile work, you know, working in a factory and so on. And so the view of the Seventh-day Adventists and the traditional view of the Churches of God is that what we're going to see at some point is the Roman Catholic Church and Europe probably starting to stamp out Sabbath keeping and enforce Sunday worship. And then the state will go out and kill Sabbath keepers. That's sort of what we've sort of heard. Well, it's not impossible, but I find it difficult to really see that happening, because today Europe is a very, very secular continent. People refer to Europe as being post-Christian. There's not that many particularly religious people in Europe. So it's hard to see how European states would want to enforce Sunday as a religious day when most of them aren't particularly religious in the first place. And of course, don't forget, it does tell us here again and again and again, it's an element of worship. It's allegiance. Are you going to convince European people to have an allegiance to the Catholic God. I'm not sure I really see that. And then again, if you're talking of stamping out Sabbath keeping by the state, is the state really that bothered by the huge number of Sabbath keepers across Europe? Not sure how many there are. Not many. I can't imagine most governments have got the slightest concern about Sabbath keepers. So I'm not saying impossible, but it seems to me a bit unlikely. But if you plug in here the Islamic realm, well, that's okay. No, they don't like any religion apart from Islam, apart from being a Muslim. And so what could the reference here be? Well, notice in verse, to get back to where we were earlier, Revelation 13, verse 18, it says, here's wisdom. Let him who's understanding calculate the number of the beast. It's the number of a man. His number is 666. What could that be? What is the number 666? Well, I've heard, and so have you, lots of ideas. Ronald Reagan, Prince Charles, Hillary Clinton, now that I could believe, Barack Obama, ditto, the Pope,
Barry.
Because in Latin his name is Vicarius Filii Dei, which counts up in Latin to 666. Will that carry on? Well, maybe, but I think unlikely still. But there is a curious feature of the Greek alphabet, which I've mentioned before. This is probably more than speculative. This is sort of very speculative, but I'll throw it in anyway. Which is that, ring two bells this time. 666 in Greek, and the book of Revelation was written in Greek. The New Testament was written in Greek, as far as we know. 666 in Greek is three letters, chi, xi, stigma. Chi 600, xi 60, stigma is 6. Hence, 666. That's the numbers. Now, the speculation here is, what if John the Apostle, in a spirit, seeing these visions, wasn't actually reading a number at all? What if he saw multitudes of people, armies with the bands on their arms and headbands on their foreheads and so on, all marked with three characters that he couldn't quite read because it's not a language he was familiar with, hint, hint, Arabic. And what if he'd not been able to read the language, he simply drew these three characters when he wrote the book of Revelation. Right? And then, of course, copyists come immediately afterwards, and perhaps early on they copy exactly these strange squiggles that John's written. But after a generation or so, people think, that's not right. That's very poor handwriting. I need to correct that and put in what it really is in Greek. So they just correct the drawing of these three characters and convert it into the nearest plausible Greek alphabet characters. Is that possible? Well, that's what some people are speculating. And so now it reads Chi Chi Stigma 666, but once upon a time it was three Arabic characters, which look very, very similar. And on the notes that we're putting up later, my wife should be putting in a picture to show the three side by side, so you can see, should be, yeah, it's a theory at least, so you can see just how close they look. And today those three characters appear on the headbands and wristbands and T-shirts and socks and who knows what not of Islamic jihadists, right? The spelling of the three Arabic characters, the first two read in the name of Allah, and the third character is the crossed swords, picture of crossed swords, which is a symbol of Islam. So if that's the case, very speculative, then Revelation 13 can read as follows. The word number can mean multitude. The number of people coming to the party tomorrow just means multitude. A great number of people at the football game, so it can mean multitude. So here we are. Here's an option. Verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him who's understanding count the multitude of the beast. For it is the multitude of a man. Let me say, how about Mohammed? Because when I was growing up, at least, I didn't refer to Muslims. We referred to Mohammedans. When I was a child, young teenage boy. That was 100 years ago, I know. But when I was growing up, these people were called Mohammedans. Not today, they're Islam or Muslims, but They were Mohammedans. So how about, here is wisdom. Let him whose understanding count the multitude of the beast, for it is the multitude of a man, Mohammed. His multitude is, quotes, in the name of Allah, or comes in the name of Allah. Okay, that's possible. That's possible. And maybe we have a jewel here. The physical headbands and armbands are symbolic. But of course, what they're implying is the allegiance of the heart. These jihadists and similar are pledging their allegiance and bearing the signs that say, I come in the name of Allah. I kill in the name of Allah. I make war in the name of Allah. So maybe, maybe not. I'll leave it there as watch this space, as they say. Now, we're in Revelation, Book of Revelation, so there's another key player I want to turn to today, which is the great harlot. Because Book of Revelation is only 20-odd chapters long, just fractionally over. It devotes two whole chapters of the 22 to the great harlot and to her destruction. So she's a key player. Takes a lot of space up in the Book of Revelation. And we've been looking here in the last 10 minutes or so at the question of the allegiance, the loyalty of people to a false god, taking the mark, showing that allegiance. Well, the great harlot plays a major role in creating and furthering that allegiance. So let's turn to Revelation 17 and find out some more about this great harlot. Like I say, a key player. And let's read verses 1 through 6. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls, which is right about that long, came and talked with me, saying to me, come, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. So we're going to read in Revelation 17 and 18 about essentially the destruction, the judgment of this great harlot. Chapter 17 sort of tends to describe the harlot, gives us some details, some hints, some clues as to who she might be. Chapter 18 then tells us of her destruction. Calamitous, complete, utterly destroyed across these two chapters. So this great harlot sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Who is this great harlot? So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and there in the wilderness I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Lots of these heads and horns around. The woman, the one in the wilderness, was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup, full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, John marveled with great amazement. So here is a vile woman, a great harlot. Who might she be? Well, here's a couple of clues. Verse 15 says, he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations and tongues or different languages. So this woman has influence internationally. That's fairly obvious. Verse 18. And the woman whom you saw is that great city, which reigns over the kings of the earth. So it appears to be a great city. It appears to have international influence. Okay. Now, I wonder where it might be. Where might this harlot be? Where might this vile woman be? Well, notice verse 3. The angel carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast there. So where is that? Where could that be? Well, I think it's a clue. I think verse 3 is a clue. We'll find the city, or the woman, in the wilderness. Wilderness is a Greek word, eremos, E-R-E-M-O-S, which means desert or lonely place. And other translations bring that out. For example, the New International Version says, "The angel carried me away in spirit into a desert, and there I saw a woman," or a great city. All right? In the eremos, in a desert. Okay, that could be a clue. The voice translation of verse 3 says, "In the middle of a vast desert, I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet-coloured beast." So if we take that as a clue and literal, the woman, the great city, is in a desert. Is that Rome? No. Rome is not in a desert. I think most of us have been there. It is not a desert. It's not a lonely place. Is it New York? Because some people say, the harlots, New York, New York City. What, lonely place? Desert? Don't think so. But if we were to just hypothetically, let's say, plug in Mecca in Saudi Arabia, would that fit? Is Mecca in Saudi Arabia? That would fit in with all the Islamic stuff we've been talking about. Daniel 2, the fourth kingdom, which we said sounds like Islam. Daniel 7, the fourth kingdom, the fourth beast, very different from all the others. That sounds a bit like Islam. Daniel 8, Turkey and Iran, both Islamic nations. Revelation 13, the beast there, looked like they could be Islamic. So Mecca could be a good fit, couldn't it? It's sort of in context it fits, but what do we know about Mecca? Well, first of all, it's in the desert. But then, I guess, to be fair, other places are. But thinking of Mecca, it's the birthplace of Islam. So if Islam is the answer to all these places we've been looking, Mecca is key. It's the birthplace of Islam. It's a spiritual centre of Islam. If you're a Mohammedan or a Muslim, you have to pray towards it 5 times a day. You point towards Mecca 5 times, and 1.7 billion people do that roughly 5 times a day. Mecca. At least once in your life, if you're a good Muslim, good Mohammedan, and I've got the money and the health, you must make a pilgrimage. The Hajj, they call it, H-A-J-J, to Mecca. And every year, 2 or 3 million people make that journey to Mecca. Mecca. We must go to Mecca. Mecca's where it all began. Mecca's the beating heart of Islam. Must get to Mecca, Mecca, Mecca. Unless, of course, you're an Iranian this year, in which case, because of the hostility between the Iranians and the Saudis, Iran banned its pilgrims this year from going to Mecca. That was last month. The Hajj changes months. The calendar, Muslim calendar, sort of moves quite a lot. But last month, September, was the Hajj, and 600,000 Iranian pilgrims didn't go to Mecca. Ooh. So, if Islam is the fourth beast and the fourth empire, and it's prophesied to be very destructive in the end time and attacking and killing saints, it wouldn't be a great surprise, would it, that we find in the book of Revelation the destruction, the complete judgment of the heart and the core of the Islam religion, in other words, Mecca. So I think it's sort of logical. I'll put that forward as a suggestion. You can obviously
pay your money, take your chance.
Let's move on to verse 4 of Revelation 17. "The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones, pearls," so on. Right? So, wealthy, perhaps obscenely wealthy. What could this be? Well, two options. The traditional view, we'd say, is it's the Catholic Church, because got a lot of money, jewels, works of art, and talks of purple and scarlet. Well, we've all seen priests and cardinals with their purple and scarlet. So, the Catholic Church. Answer, well, not right, maybe, but equally, Mecca and the Saudi royal family, are some of the wealthiest on the face of the earth. There are 15,000 royals in the Saudi royal family, which sounds like an awful lot of people. Many of them are billionaires. They have a lavish lifestyle. They drive cars made of gold and encrusted with diamonds, some of them. Some of the locals in Mecca now refer to it as Las Vegas. I don't think that's complimentary. That's just getting so bad over there. And, of course, Saudi Arabia is an immensely wealthy country, thanks to the oil. So verse 4 talks about really royalty and wealth. Catholic Church, maybe. Mecca and Saudi Arabia, again, I think it fits. It's not too hard to see that. And by the way, the Iranians think the Saudi royal family are all apostate, obscene slobs. And it's time they were kicked out. And Iran took over control and management of the holy city of Mecca and Medina. So there's a lot of hostility there. Verse 5. On her forehead, on this woman's forehead, a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. Well, okay. We've said in the past, that could be the Catholic Church, because mother of harlots, that's a Catholic Church. And the harlots, of which she's mother, are all the Protestant churches, because, you know, Catholic Church was the mother church. And then all the Protestants, you know, Martin Luther and John Calvin and all that lot, all spin-offs, but all same type of mother. So that's just what that is. It's just the Catholic Church. Well, okay. We don't think it's obviously the original Babylon, because it says here it's Mystery Babylon the Great. It's got to be revealed. This is not the original Babylon, which you find today in Iraq. It's mystery. You have to reveal who this Babylon is. But notice the mother of harlots. Well, if you think back to the days of Saddam Hussein and some of the battles he had with the Americans, as one battle was forthcoming, he said, this will be the mother of all battles. So actually it's a Middle East term for the biggest or the worst. This is the mother of all battles. It didn't mean there's going to be lots more battles coming off that into the future. It just means it's the biggest. It's the worst. So the mother of harlots in some Middle East language is simply the worst harlot, the biggest harlot. And of course, there's a fair chance that can be Islam. Verse 6. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Again, you can think of the Catholic Church and the Inquisitions of the past. Yeah, could be that. But equally, think of Islam over the centuries and even today. You haven't got to go far today to find that in many, many Muslim countries, it's pretty hard to be any type of Christian. You know, back in the 500s AD, perhaps through the early 600s AD, North Africa was a Christian area. The Middle East was Syria, was Christian. Not today. All these territories are now under Islamic rule. And today, if you convert in any Muslim country to become a Christian of any sort, they're very, very intolerant. They burn churches. They kill people. So Islam has a lot of blood in its hands. It's a very intolerant religion where they have the power to be so. The Quran actually instructs jihad against even the people of the book. That's Jews and, you know, Christians. And there's an article I read earlier today, the worst places to be a Christian on the earth. It was the top 25 worst places, and the top half dozen were Iraq, which is Muslim, Syria, which is Muslim, Afghanistan, which is Muslim, Sudan, which is Muslim, Iran, which is Muslim, Pakistan, which is Muslim, Saudi Arabia, which is Muslim, and you get the you get the hint. Only one that wasn't Muslim, I think, was North Korea. Actually, anybody in North Korea is in trouble. Even the North Koreans are in trouble. But ignoring North Korea, every other country where you do not want to be a Christian, in a sense, Islamic countries. So, blood of the saints, yeah, Islam fits in perfectly there. Okay, let's read verses 7 to 18, still in this great harlot. We're describing her before reading about her destruction. So So far, I see this great harlot, this great city, as Mecca, the home base of the Islamic religion. Verses 7 to 18. The angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has seven heads and the 10 horns. The beast that you saw, with the woman sitting, and is not, sorry, the beast that you saw was, and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was, and is not, and yet is." I don't think that beast is here yet. That's clear. We'll make this totally clear. No chance. Verse 9, "Here is the mind, which is wisdom." That lets us all out. "The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue." This really is clear, isn't it? "For a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition." Gets even clearer. "And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who receive no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast." So that part probably a little bit clearer. There are 10 nations, 10 kings who come together for a very brief period with the beast at the very end time. "These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to this beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful." That tells us that's the very end time. So these 10 nations, 10 kingdoms, who share their power of the beast, actually try to fight off the Lord Jesus at his return. This is very, very, very end of the age. Got that part. "And he said to me, the waters which you saw with the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues." So that's international. "The 10 horns which you saw on the beast will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire." It's ironic because she sits on them, but this marriage doesn't last very long. "For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth." Okay, well, let's try and unpack that as far as we can without getting too hopelessly confused in verses, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, which are a bit tricky. Let's start with verses 7 through 11, and I'll try my best to unpick it. "The angel said to me, why did you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, the beast having seven heads and 10 horns." The 10 horns we already read are 10 kings right at the end who make war with Jesus. Ignore them for now. "The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to destruction. Those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom." Here's the clue. "The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits." And then, of course, people have said, well, that's it. Seven hills, that's Rome. We all know, Rome's a city on seven hills. Therefore, this is Rome. Well, of course, it doesn't say that at all. It says seven mountains, not seven hills. That tells us what they are. Verse 9, reading straight through to 10. "The seven heads are seven mountains, not hills, on which the woman sits. And they are also seven kings," which is how the New American Standard Bible translates it. So it's one thing. These seven mountains are seven kings, seven kingdoms. Carrying on. "Five have fallen." So it's not Rome. There aren't five hills which have disappeared from Rome. There are seven kings, seven mountains, or seven kings or kingdoms. Five have already fallen. One is present, one is here and now, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. This appears to be the clue. Five have fallen. One is in existence. And then one more is yet to come, making seven. Now, you can go in a couple of different directions here. I'm going to suggest that the one is that when John is writing his book of Revelation in 90 AD or thereabouts, five empires have gone, they've fallen. One is Rome, and one is yet to come. I'm going to suggest that the one yet to come is the Islamic Empire. So five have gone, one is, and one is yet to come after John's time, after 90 AD. Who might these empires be? Well, you can argue a wee bit, but it looks a very good probability that these are seven empires which Satan has used from the beginning to dominate, persecute, destroy God's people, and at times when it's existed, Jerusalem, the city of God. Are there seven kingdoms that can do that? Yes, there are. Number one would be Egypt, because that's where Israel began. You know, Jacob went down, developed down there, they multiplied, but of course ended up in slavery. So the first time in the nation of Israel, they were enslaved in Egypt. So Egypt could be empire number one, the first mountain, followed by Assyria, who took captive the house of Israel. We get all that in the Bible. Followed by number three, Babylon, which of course destroyed Jerusalem, took Jeremiah, Daniel captive. Four, Medo-Persia, they came after Babylon. Fairly straightforward. Number five, Greece, they took over after them, including rule of Jerusalem, Palestine. Number six, Rome, because again, they're over Palestine, over many of God's people, and John's writing the book of Revelation circa 90 AD, give or take a few years. So John says, five have fallen, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. One is Rome out there all around me, and one yet to come. That would be the Islamic Caliphate Empire, probably, I'm going to suggest, 1453 to his deadly wound in 1922. 1453 was the defeat of Constantinople, which is the final defeat of the Roman Empire. And actually, in some ways, if you think about it, it's perhaps not too important who they were, because this is history. And I suppose most of them were concerned about, but what's happening next? Never mind the historical part. Argue whether the second one was Assyria or somebody else. Who's the next? That's the one we're more interested in. And notice verse 11. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth. The eighth, not just seven. But notice he's one of the seven coming back again. Verse 11, the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, but actually is of the seven, and he's also going to destruction. So one of the seven is coming back to form the eighth. Okay, which one of the seven is coming back? I'm going to suggest it's the Islamic Caliphate Empire. That's going to be the deadly wound will be healed. The Ottoman Empire ended in 1922. The Caliphate was disbanded in 1924. I believe Daniel 8 shows us it's coming back. Turkey is probably going to restore that. So I don't personally see Rome sort of featuring here. To me, this is definitely talking about one of the seven, in my view, the seventh, the Islamic Caliphate Empire, is coming back. Its deadly wound will be healed. And sometime next few years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever, we will see, much to our, I guess, amazement, the rekindled, resurrected, re-empowered and healed Islamic Empire. Which would be bad news for anybody who is a Christian, especially if you're living under Islamic rule. But let's not forget entirely the traditional view, so let me just cover that, and so you know why I differ slightly from it. If you are familiar with the Ambassador College Bible Correspondence course, or booklets about who is the beast, mark of the beast, all that carry on, these seven mountains are identified as seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. And if that is the case, then it always looked to me, to be fair, to be blunt, a bit arbitrary who was a resurrected part of that. But in theory, Justinian was number one, Charlemagne was number two, Otto the Great was number three, Charles the Great of the Habsburg dynasty was number four, Napoleon, number five. I don't really get why it's these people rather than other powerful kings and emperors, so, but that was what it's supposed to be. Number six was Italy under Mussolini, right? And then one more yet to come. One final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire yet ahead of us. That's how that works. Remember the clue. Five are fallen, one is, and one is yet to come. When I said one is when John was writing the book of Revelation, when he saw Rome. That's the one that is. Then one more yet to come. Well, Mr. Armstrong took the view that the one is a reference to when the prophecy of Revelation would be understood. In other words, in his day, when he was studying Book of Daniel, Book of Revelation, and he also thought probably John the Apostle in spirit, when he said one is, that John was in the 1930s in spirit, 1940s, and John saw out there one is, and what John saw was Italy under Mussolini. So a combination of that's where John was in prophecy, the 1930s, 40s, and Mr. Armstrong understanding the prophecies in 1930s, 40s, he said, that's it. The one that is Italy. And there's one more to come. Well, I think that's a bit sort of shaky, because Mr. Armstrong, to be fair to him, actually genuinely believed that the end was imminent in the 1930s. I mean, literally imminent. He looked round at Mussolini, at Hitler, at the world at war, death, destruction everywhere, and he figured out, this is it. This is the sixth one. But, again, being blunt, not trying to tread on people's toes, Mr. Armstrong was miles off the mark in his understanding of prophecy. For example, and this is in his own words, so I didn't make this up, the March 1938 Plain Truth, before my time, honestly, Mr. Armstrong said and believed, Mussolini and the Pope will hatch up an idea of setting up a world headquarters at Jerusalem. And so Mussolini's armies will enter Palestine, see Daniel 11:41, and eventually will capture half the city of Jerusalem. So in March 1938, Mr. Armstrong thought Mussolini and the Pope would join forces and enter Jerusalem. That's what he believed. The January 1939 Plain Truth, Mussolini will fight Christ. That's what he believed. That's how he came to his, the one that is Italy, but he clearly was wrong. So that's why I'm saying the one that is was never Italy. The May-June 1941 Plain Truth, Hitler now emerges as the beast of Revelation. So Mr. Armstrong's views of, 80 years ago might have looked right at the time, looking around at the horrible world we lived in, but obviously they weren't accurate. So selecting the one that is, must be Italy under Mussolini, doesn't work. For me, that doesn't work. I can't go with that. So therefore, I feel much more comfortable saying the one that is the one that was in front of John when he was actually writing down the book of Revelation. That's the one that is Rome. Okay, that's sort of where I got that from. Okay, back to Revelation 17, picking up in verse 12 to 14. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind. They will give their power and authority to the beast, and these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. So, ten nations combining together with the beast and fighting Christ. Well, if you go down the Roman route, this is ten European nations, a United States of Europe, sort of comes from there. I don't feel very comfortable with that understanding for all the reasons I've expressed. To me, it's more likely to be 10 Islamic nations in a confederation under the revived Islamic Caliphate, I think. Verses 15 through 18, verse 16, sorry. The 10 horns which you saw on the beast will hate the harlot. They hate Mecca and all she stands for. You might think, well, that's a bit odd, isn't it? If that's a sort of centre headquarters of Islam, but then, you know, Mecca, obscenely wealthy, known by its locals as Las Vegas, with what many believe to be totally corrupt royal family. So I can see this happening. The 10 horns which you saw on the beast will hate the harlot, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. And God's put into the hearts to do that. Well, to burn with fire, yeah, it's not hard to imagine today. Missiles, possibly nuclear weaponry. You can burn Mecca, all right. That's not going to be too hard. And a lot of Islamic countries either hate Mecca and its wealth or they're jealous of it. That's somewhat similar because of its power, its influence, the way it deals with the West, the USA. A lot of people see the USA as a great Satan. How can a Saudi Arabian family deal with the West? It's corrupt, they see it, apostate, decadent. They hate it. They're going to turn on Mecca, the great city, in the wilderness at the end. Revelation 18 brings us to the actual sort of judgment or destruction of this great city. The harlot, remember, verses chapter 17 and 18 go together. It's the judgment of the great harlot. This is just continuing, verses 1 through 8 for today. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. He cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great, who might that be, is fallen, and has become habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. And incidentally, just in passing, I've heard oodles of born-again, secret rapture, believing evangelical sorts say that Jesus made all foods clean. You know, Mark chapter 7 and Matthew 15 and Peter and the Cornelius episode in Acts 10, everything was made clean. Well, it's nonsense, isn't it? Because here we are at the very, very, very end and there's unclean birds still around, like vultures and eagles and parrots. Can't eat them. I don't want to disappoint you, but you can't eat vultures. There are unclean foods today. There are, still are. Verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Wine, I'm going to suggest, say later, is probably oil. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, illicit relationships. The merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury and all that Persian Gulf oil. That's what makes the world turn. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, unless you receive of her plagues. What's God's people doing there, you wonder? For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she has rendered to you. Repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix for her double. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, margin says sensually, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow, for she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, am no widow, and will not see sorrow. Therefore, her plagues will come in one day. I think that's probably literal. So you're looking at powerful weapons, possibly nuclear weapons. Her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she'll be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. I mean, this is total destruction of this great city. It says destruction one day, and then it mentions here utterly burned with fire. The Amplified says completely consumed. The voice says, incinerated with fire. So this great city, referred to here as Babylon the Great, is going to be utterly, totally razed to the ground. Just smoke and fire and burning and absolute destruction. Now, it's referred to here as Babylon the Great, up in verse 2. In context, I'm saying that's still Mecca, because nothing's changed. But some people say, well, it says Rome. Some say it's New York, still. Well, if you recollect what we've seen already, as I sort of wrap up here, chapter 17 talked about mystery Babylon. It's not the original Babylon. This is a mystery Babylon, a daughter of Babylon. The original Babylon is just nothing there today. And it's in Iraq, not far from Baghdad, nothing there. So it's not that one. Revelation 17:3 says it's in the wilderness, in the desert. Well, I think Mecca fits perfectly there. Revelation 17:6 says it persecutes and kills the saints. Well, Islam, headquartered in Mecca, does that. I don't think Rome has done that much for 400 years, 500 years. Don't really see it coming back, personally. And, of course, New York hasn't done it too much, really. Babylon the Great has relationships with the kings of the earth, the presidents, the CEOs, the businessmen, uses its resources to develop illicit relationships. Well, I'm pretty sure the wine of her fornication is oil. That's what makes the world tick. Oil. And, of course, how many people have made billions of dollars of profit on the oil from the Middle East, especially from Saudi Arabia? And, of course, the oil wealth has allowed the Saudi family, the royal family, to live in absolute, complete, almost obscene luxury. The wine of her luxuries. So as far as I'm concerned, I'll carry on a wee bit more next week. Mecca, the centre and headquarters of Islam, fits perfectly. And I see Revelation 17 and 18 as telling us about the forthcoming destruction of Mecca sometime, hopefully, fairly soon. And I think you can almost look forward to that, can't you? All the pain it's going to cause, all the pain it has caused, the hundreds of millions of deaths, the subjugation, humiliation of peoples for centuries. Yeah, it'll be good to see the final end of Islam and Mecca. Okay, I think with that, we may as well conclude today's Bible study.